Hey, and welcome to episode number 7 of The Bloody Pit. This is turning into an odd series of podcasts. When I first started doing The Bloody Pit, I honestly thought that I would end up doing a whole lot more podcasts about horror movies, scary movies, things of that nature, European horror, exploitation, stuff of that nature. Kind of an outside the cinema done by different people with different tastes and odd kind of perspectives on things. But that's not how it's working out. But that's okay. This was always going to be a strange podcast, and this one, we got to add to the list. So, this time out, what you're getting is something I did about 5 or 6 years ago, which is a commentary track, a full-length commentary track that I recorded for the movie The Giant Behemoth from 1959. Now, the reason I recorded this is that there was a DVD, a very fine DVD that was put out by Warner Brothers, but I was unhappy with the commentary track that was available on it. I just found it to be kind of, snarky and kind of insulting to the movie that it was meant to be lauding, and kind of bringing to your attention the various elements of the film that are worth talking about, worth paying attention to. And so I was unhappy with that, so I spent several months gathering a lot of material, interviews with various people behind the scenes and a couple of the actors to bring you as much information as I could about the making of The Giant Behemoth, and kind of make an interesting and informative commentary track that takes you through the movie and allows you to understand and enjoy the film a little bit more. And maybe if you don't think too much of it, maybe this commentary track gives you that much more of a perspective on it. Now, I recorded this commentary track a few years ago, and the reason that I'm putting it out as a podcast now is simply because I had it available as a download, and you know, several hundred people downloaded it and really have really enjoyed it over the years. But I don't have that particular the site that I had it stored on, the file sharing site. I no longer have an account there, so I was going to re-up it, and was scrambling around and realized I didn't have a copy of the file. So if you enjoy this, and if you enjoy listening to this commentary track, just add your voice of happiness and praise to Brother D of a Mail Order Zombie in 1951 Down Place, who luckily is one of the people who had pulled the file down a long while back and had held on to it. So when I went searching for it, realized I couldn't find the damn thing, he was nice enough to step forward and help me out. So, Brother D, once again, all of us owe you our thanks. Or at least I definitely owe you my thanks. Without you, this wouldn't exist, and people wouldn't be able to hear me prattle on for an hour and a half about a 1959 stop motion animated monster movie. So, all thanks to Brother D. If you enjoy this podcast, thank you very much. Please write and let me know about it. The address you can reach me at, the email address would be thebloodypit@gmail.com. Please let me know what you think. And this is a weird format for this podcast. I've never done this before, and I may do it again in the future. I'm not sure. It's really a lot of hard work to do a full-length commentary track. Now, remember, you can sync this commentary track up, and once it starts, I give you a kind of a countdown so that you can start the movie and handle it that way if you wish, but you don't have to. You can treat this kind of the way I treat the podcast Terror Transmission, which is they go through the film almost as a commentary track, but as long as you know the film, you don't really need to be watching the movie while they go through it and comment on it and give you lots of information and production notes and information about the actors and the creators. So I think that you can do that as well. If you've recently seen The Giant Behemoth, you can probably just listen to this commentary track and glean a lot of information from it. And The show notes for this podcast will tell you all the various places that I found all this information and the various interviews by different people and the fantastic books from which I gathered all this info. So I really hope you enjoy it. Kick back and give it a listen. If you do, let me know about it. And I'd love to be able to tell you what the next podcast of this is going to be. I will say this. For future Bloody Pit podcasts, I am trying to pull together an episode centered around Godzilla in one way or another. And I'm also putting together an episode that will focus on the Beastmaster, which if you listen to your podcast, you'll know the jokes are already a-flying when you start talking about the Beastmaster. So Thank you very much. Check out the commentary track for The Giant Behemoth, and I will see you again next time.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Down Place can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Down Place, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Hello and welcome to my audio commentary for the film The Giant Behemoth, released in 1958. My name is Rod Barnett, and I will attempt to take you through this film, provide a little information along the way, and maybe a few entertaining stories about its conception, its filming, and its reception. First, let's get this thing queued up. We'll try to set you up here very easily. Just take the film, hopefully you have the DVD, load it up. Get the film right at its beginning with that very nice Allied Artist Productions, Inc. Frame right over the ocean. And we'll count down from 5 to 1, and on 1 we'll start the film and I will start this commentary. Before I do that, let me say that quite a bit of research has gone into this. I have sought out interviews, several interviews with the great Tom Weaver. Some of the quotes I'll be giving you will be from Mark F. Berry's wonderful book, The Dinosaur Filmography. Also, an interview with Desmond Davies, and quite a few other little bits and pieces along the way. Like I say, hope you enjoy it, and here's our countdown to start the commentary. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. The film begins with that wonderful shot of the ocean, I assume the Atlantic Ocean, but who knows, could just be stock footage. And we have the voice of God giving us that quote from Job 14:1, giving us our title in one form or another, actually. And the wonderful music of Edwin Astley comes up. Mr. Astley was one of the lesser-known filmmakers involved in this along the way. He was primarily known for doing quite a lot of music for British television. He did do a number of films over the years, but mostly his credits involve television. Episodes of The Saint, Gideon's Way, The Champions, Danger Man, supposedly. He did do the score for Hammer's The Phantom of the Opera, as well as a few other interesting titles as well. But this is a very good little score, and one that I think is not as well known as it could or probably should be to a large degree. The music is not always used as effectively in the movie as I would like myself, but it is still a very good score. And there we have a good beginning to any film, an atomic explosion. Nothing like a mushroom cloud to get things moving. Okay, a little background on this. This is the least remembered and least revered of director Eugene Lorre's 3 dinosaur-themed films. With neither the genre-defining originality of the first, which was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, nor the technicolor spectacle, or the warm fuzzy mommy-come-gets-the-baby plotline of Gorgo, Behemoth is usually overlooked and quite often forgotten. It doesn't really deserve that. It's a much better film than its reputation would generally lead you to believe. There is our American star, Gene Evans, As is usual with most genre films made during this period of time, British films made in the genre of horror and or science fiction would always try to import an American star, either a rising one or one whose, shall we say, career was on the wane, to boost the film's saleability in the States. Evans is the only American star in this, but the film is packed with a lot of fine British actors, and even though I think Evans at times outshines them, they work well together. There's some good repartee between the various actors and some very interesting scenes just because the actors play them well. Here we have Evans setting up the deadly information that will come into play later. The film was produced by a man named David Diamond under the banner of the Allied Artists Limited. It's a production distribution deal combining the monies of Allied Artists and several other companies. The interiors of the film were done at National Studio Elstree in Bornham. The live action was lensed in London and in a small village near Cornwall. And the effects work was done in California. And we'll get to the effects work later on. Eugene Laurie, very interesting man. with quite a bit of information on him we'll get back to later on. But he volunteered to do the script. He was hired by these people to work on what eventually became The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And after that, he was hired to do the film that eventually became Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. He volunteered to do the script with the assistance of two blacklisted screenwriters. And then after that, he was enticed to direct it. After The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms came out and made millions of dollars, it was eventually decided that by someone that they would want to do another film of this type. So 4 years later, the idea for the film The Black Scorpion was generated. And in this case, Laurie was approached to direct again, and he was introduced to Willis O'Brien and Pete Peterson. O'Brien and Peterson hadn't done a film together since Mighty Joe Young, and they accepted the offer to do the Black Scorpion's stop motion work cheaply in Mexico City. They worked out of Peterson's garage in Encino. O'Brien was getting older, but he was. He and Peterson worked together to create the special effects. Now, Laurie walked off the film for various reasons, but the animation done by O'Brien and Peterson was extremely good. And so later on, when Laurie got the Giant Behemoth script in hand, or shall we say wrote it, he remembered this, and this is how the combination of Laurie and O'Brien and Peterson came up. And the film we're currently watching came to be. Now, on screen right now, we have some of the shots done in Cornwall. We're introduced to the older fisherman and his daughter, and we get our first encounter between the behemoth and a human being. One, of course, at this point, the monster is still kept off screen, but that's the way it's supposed to go. Now, it is interesting to note that Eugene Laurie, director, had a few problems with both of these actors. He was not too happy with either one of them, and mainly because the gentleman on screen there was the actor in question. His name is Henry Vidon, or Vidon, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, but of course... he was a Shakespearean actor and was considered very difficult by the director. The quote is, he had a traditional old-style delivery that clashed with the fisherman he was supposed to play. The girl who played his daughter, Lee Madison, while being very pretty, was worse, he claimed. He says, I think Dave Diamond picked her because she was good-looking. Well, you're making a movie, that's a pretty good reason, I guess. The Cornwall scenes were filmed silent and looped by the players in post-production, which was pretty standard, especially any place where there would be a lot of loud background noise, like the surf of the ocean, of course. Now, a year after Laurie walked off of The Black Scorpion, independent producer David Diamond approached him with a project that would eventually become Behemoth the Sea Monster. Now, Behemoth the Sea Monster is the British title for this film, which is, I think, a much better title for the film in general than The Giant Behemoth, which is what we got stuck with here in the States. But Diamond's career went back to the old Universal days. His claim to fame was the uniting of Karloff and Lugosi for The Raven in 1935, and Diamond asked Laurie to write a script from a story about radioactive pollution in the ocean and its consequences on a large metropolitan area. The property had been penned by Robert Abel and Irving Adler. Now, Adler had co-authored the original story for Forbidden Planet. Laurie claimed that there was no shooting title for Behemoth, and the quote from him is, "In fact, the script I was given contained no beast at all. The only element specified was something electrically charged and dangerous, a kind of radioactive substance floating on the water. It was an interesting idea and way ahead of its time. I tried to invent visual means to translate the dangers of radiation to the screen, but the concept did not sit well at all with the distributors. A surprise request from Allied Artist and Eros Films came in to change the story and reuse a prehistoric monster such as the one in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. The success of that picture made the entrepreneurs envious, so we went back to The Beast again." That's how it happened. So, Diamond hired a female writer to revamp the story, and 3 weeks later, a few scant pages were turned in. Laurie once again says, "That script was very bad." And the date approached when Diamond had to submit a shooting script in order to sign a contract. At that point, I described a scene that was scientifically exciting. Diamond begged me to write the script quickly, as he had a 2-week deadline. So, based on that scene, I proceeded to write the script in haste with my friend Dan Hyatt, with the understanding that it would be polished before filming. Well, one thing that you learn pretty quickly in the movie business, apparently, is that things don't always go that well. And Laurie always complained that he never got a chance to polish that script. No one ever had another hand on it. So that version of the script, the original version that Laurie put together himself, is the one that got filmed. Laurie made preliminary sketches of the Behemoth and approached Willis O'Brien and Pete Peterson. They had finished Black Scorpion and were anxious for more work. He introduced them to Diamond as a team capable of executing all of the effects. That didn't turn out to be how it happened. We'll get to that later. Now on screen, of course, we have the discovery of our dead fisherman. Well, he's not dead yet, but he definitely does not look very good, and we get our statement of the title beast's name, or at least the name that gets assigned to it. Now, before we go any further, I want to give a little information about Eugene Laurie. He was born in the early 1900s. He died in 1991. He is best known outside of the three films that he directed, with the three monster films he directed, for being a set designer for lots of different films. He worked as a painter and a ballet set designer in France. Laurie turned to films, began a long association with famed French director Jean Renoir, worked on films such as The Grand Illusion, The Human Beast, and The Rules of the Game. In 1941, during the Nazi occupation, French filmmakers, including Laurie, Renoir, Claire, Ulfels, and others with whom Laurie had worked, fled for Hollywood. He said, "I was a very known art director in France, and when a lot of people escaped from France, I decided to go where the films were made. Jean Renoir came here, that is, to the United States, and I came here as well. Hollywood was like a giant magnet." Laurie quickly found employment in Hollywood. He reteamed with Renoir on his stateside films and also art-directed such 40s fare as The House of Fear, that's one of the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes films, and Abbott and Costello's In Society. Weaver notes that he vaguely remembered working on an Invisible Man film, and he surmises that it might have been The Invisible Man's Revenge, which came out in 1944. In 1952, Laurie was offered the director's chair for the first time on Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and if you listen to Laurie in later years, that really kind of set his career on a certain path, and he was never allowed to really become the kind of director that he wanted to be. It's somewhat of a shame, I think, that Lorre had the view of his film, of his monster films that he did, but his career definitely didn't suffer as he continued designing films. He worked on everything from Chaplin's Limelight in 1952 all the way up to Clint Eastwood's film Bronco Billy in 1980. He even returned to acting with a small bit in the Richard Gere film Breathless, the 1983 film that was a remake of the classic movie. Now we're to the discovery of the lump of stuff on the beach, and the pulsing lump of stuff. I've always liked the image of that, where they kind of blur the image to make it look as if, to me it's always looked as if it's either radiating heat or radiation or something of that nature. It gives it a nice creepy feel, yeah, especially the pulsing. Of course, one wonders, what did they do with that pulsing stuff, and why doesn't it show up again later in the film? At any rate, shooting for the film began in April 1958 on a beastly cold day near the River Thames. Lurie's head cameraman was Ken Hodges, but it was camera operator Desmond Davies who would later grab the brass ring. As an operator, Davis worked on a slew of memorable pictures, from the definitive Alistair Sim version of Scrooge in 1951 to creepy little films like The Crawling Eye as well. In the 60s, he gained status as a director and eventually helmed Clash of the Titan, Ray Harryhausen's very last movie. It took Lorre exactly 24 days to wrap live action for Behemoth. 20 were spent in London and 4 in Cornwall for the atmospheric scenes of the fishing village, the sea, and the cove, where Henry Vidden does his horrible deaths, has his horrible death scene. One note that I would like to make is, a few scenes ago we had the scene at the graveyard where they were burying the fisherman character, and that is a pretty rare thing in monster movies of this time period. Generally, the victims of the monster, of the various giant rampaging monsters we've never shown their funerals or anyone actually having any showing any real grief over them, and that makes this film unique. And I think that shows up again and again, especially if you pay attention to the structure of the movie. The movie really is structured somewhat as a mystery. Now, it's been pointed out repeatedly about this film that it looks very much like a film noir. The lighting, and I love the camera movement as well. There are a lot of long scenes of dialogue between people in which Lorre will move the camera around a little bit to keep things interesting. And I think it says a lot that he had a good enough cast that he was able to do that kind of thing with. Now, Gene Evans, I hope I have not been calling him by the wrong name this entire time. Anyway, Mr. Evans talks about how he got the role in this film. He had done a picture for producer David Diamond at Allied Artists called Revolt in the Big House, which also came out in 1958. He said, "I was broke," which I was a lot of the time. And David Diamond said that they were going to be doing it in no time at all, and they offered me pretty good money. Then later, when the giant behemoth came up and I said I didn't want to do it, Diamond said, "We're going to England to film it." Now, this is what excited Mr. Evans, because he had been in England during World War II as a serviceman, and he was there right up until the Normandy invasion. It was over. He said, "I was overseas 3 years, but you're on such a nickel and dime thing when you're in the army. I wanted to go back there when I could afford to go to the places that I couldn't go to when I was a soldier. And they probably wouldn't have let me in anyway. But if you have money, you get in anywhere." So that was the reason for taking the job. That and the fact that I met the director, Gene Lorre, and I liked him immensely. He was a hell of an artist. He knew music. He was a set designer. Just an all-around talented guy. He tried to make a good mystery picture out of this, and I think it was a pretty good picture. I knew it was a hell of a lot of work. At this point, he talks at length about having to memorize the technical scientific names of fish and everything for the scene coming up where they take a look at the radioactive fish. He's got a pretty funny story about the day they filmed that, but One of the odder things about this movie is that because it was a British co-production, they had to have a British co-director. Laurie talked about how he was assigned a man named Douglas Hickox as his co-director. He says, Doug was very young and a very good assistant. Since then, he's achieved some status as a director in England. At the time of Behemoth, he was considered to be a good second-line action director. I also had some very effective help from Ted Lloyd, the assistant producer. For some reason, Hickox's name did not appear on the billing. Now, it is my understanding that Hickox's name does appear in the credits for on the British print of the film. And if that is so, I've not seen proof of that, but I would like to eventually see that just for curiosity's sake. Now, when Tom Weaver asked Gene Evans about this particular thing, Evans was very upfront about it and as usual, had quite a lot to say. Evans said, the union rules over there call for an English co-director, so we had two directors, both Laurie and Douglas Hickox. Dougie was a nice fellow, but he was in a lousy spot. Anybody would be. A guy comes in with a script he has prepared, and then he has to work with this other guy. But Hickox was a competent director. He worked out very well working with the other actors. In fact, everybody but me, I think, was English. And, of course, that is true. Now, as we have on scene yet another nice scene involving Andre Morel and Mr. Evans, there they are, I think it's a good idea to point out right now that Andre Morel's career was very long and very varied and incredibly impressive. This is one of the smaller films in his repertoire. His most recent work would have been in... The last film he has a credit for is the Great Train Robbery. As a judge, he did the voice of Elrond in the animated Lord of the Rings film in 1978. He was in dozens of films, including episodes of Doctor Who, several Hammer films, The Mummy's Shroud, Plague of the Zombies, Vengeance of She, although I'm sure Vengeance of She is not exactly one of the great beloved ones, but he was also in She. He was in episodes of The Saint, Danger Man, various other films. Apparently had a role in Ben-Hur and the Hammer Hound of the Baskervilles. Also, and this is the most exciting thing for me, is he played Professor Bernard Quatermass in the original 6-episode version done for British television of Quatermass and the Pit. If you've never seen that one, allow me to highly recommend it. But of course, he was also in Bridge on the River Kwai. His list of credits are impressive. And the thing about Andre Morel is he's always interesting to watch, and he's a very good actor. Even though I would complain that there are a couple of points in this film where he underplays a little too much. Nice special effects makeup work on the actor's hand there. Looks very good. The special effects makeup on the actor's faces later on during the ferry boat scene are also just as good. Not sure those boots really show off Mr. Evans's legs quite to the effect that they should. But once again, some beautiful shooting here in Cornwall. I know that it had to be freezing cold. As a matter of fact, several of the people who were there comment on just how incredibly cold it is. And anytime you see some people at the beach wrapped in coats and sweaters, and you know it had to be miserable, freezing cold out there. But once again, built like a mystery. This film is built like a mystery, and here we see the characters putting together the pieces of the puzzle, trying to figure out what's going on. Another thing I'd like to comment on about this film is that I really love the fact that with all the on-location filming, you really do get a sense of this place. You get a sense of this little village, the people involved in it, even though later on, as the film goes on, we move away from that, of course, as the monster moves into London and starts attacking. It still really does feel as if we are getting that wonderful slow build. getting our information, getting our story slowly put together, getting these characters in front of us, getting to know them, getting to like them, and then letting these things play out. It's a deliberate choice in storytelling that I always like, and it's something that is not done nearly as often in the modern day. In films these days, it seems that there's far too much desire to get the story jump-started immediately, jump right into it. Of course, this film started with a nuclear explosion, so maybe I'm kind of talking out of one side of my mouth on this one, but the slow build, as was stated earlier, the building of this like a mystery is a wonderful choice, in my opinion, and it's one of the reasons why the film is so revisitable, if that's even a word. It's something that I like to come back to and rewatch because it does have this build. That's one of the joys of it, is that it's fun to watch them putting the pieces together. And as I say, and I like a scene like this, it's fun to watch these actors play off each other. They do it quite well. Does it bug anybody else that he says algae instead of algae? Is algae the correct pronunciation? I don't really know. I think one of the funnier things that Mr. Evans says about Andre Morel, well, I'll just quote what he says. Weaver asks him about Andre Morel, says most of your scenes were with British actor Andre Morel, and Evans says, Andre was a character. I liked him. He was full of it. I mean, really full of it. He was just a bluff kind of guy, but fun to be around. He had been in motion pictures and on the stage all of his life, and everything was my dear boy this and my dear boy that, and you couldn't understand his dialogue. I watched his lips most of the time, and when they stopped moving, I started talking. He was so English. It was mumble, mumble, well now, mumble, mumble, my dear boy, blah, 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 so you see. He was very effective, but difficult to understand. Well, now we come to one of the more interesting scenes. The first time I saw this movie, I'll have to admit that I thought of this as a scene that goes on for far too long, and it is pretty lengthy, but it's there to serve a purpose. Of course, its purpose, story-wise, is to advance the mystery, advance the story, and show us how we're piecing this mystery together and doing it bit by bit, piece by piece. But I have to relate this very amusing tale of the day this scene got filmed. Mr. Evans there was, let's just say, not feeling very well. He says, I don't think there was a day I worked on that I didn't die with a hangover. Seems that he really liked his drink at the time, and he went out pretty much every night and had a good time. He really did want to have a good time over there, and he was making up for the time he did not get to do this when he was in the service. He says, I wasn't supposed to work one day. They were going to shoot exteriors. I had been out whooping it up pretty good the night before, and boy, they called me about 7 a.m. I'd been in bed 2 hours then. They said, we've got to go in and shoot the laboratory scenes. Oh, Jesus, don't tell me that. Boy, I was sick. I was hungover and my stomach hurt. So I gulped down a couple of aspirins and a cup of coffee. And boy, they had terrible coffee in England. And they sent a car over for me. I went into the studio, and there was this flounder I was supposed to dissect. I was supposed to... Oh man, that poor fish hadn't seen water in God knows how long. It was slimy and stunk so bad that two of the people working with me got sick. I was ill the whole day from that, and God, I could not get that smell off of me that night. I just soaked and soaked, and it wouldn't go away. That was one of those days when you wish that you did something else for a living. The scene with the flounder was not supposed to be shot till much later in the schedule, so I hadn't really boned up on it. You should be able to think on your feet and get on with it, and it wouldn't have been such a problem if I hadn't been such a, and here he says something that I'm not sure won't offend most people, but he calls himself a total asshole and gone out and misbehaved all night.
I find it amusing that now when I watch this scene, I'm just looking to see if I can tell if he's hungover, if he's in that much pain or what. And I have to say, maybe it's just a credit to him as an actor. I can't tell. He seems to be doing just fine. The fact that he was feeling terrible just adds a kind of smile to me as I try to watch it. There we go. Good close-up of him where you're thinking, is he really feeling that bad? At any rate. As this scene shows very clearly, one of the nice characteristics of the film itself is that it tries to stick very close to reality for as long as it can, so that when we get to the very fantastical element of the giant rampaging monster, we've been led to it carefully and slowly and kind of methodically. This is done very smartly throughout the film. There's an early reference to Operation Crossroads, which was the actual code name for the Bikini Atomic Tests, the radiation detection methodology. Is very realistic. The dissection of the flounder, of course, and the forging of the torpedo radium warhead that's used later on to dispatch our giant monster are very, very detailed and are as scientifically accurate as they can be. The details tend to ring true. Now, I'll quote now from Mark Berry's Dinosaur Filmography. One might fear that such meticulousness would bog things down. On the contrary, it actually makes the tale more compelling. Comparing this approach to the typical bubblegum sci-fi babble of most 1950s monster movies, the difference is staggering. Grimly, the film's greatest scientific truth lies in its real-world warnings about the dangers of nuclear testing and waste dumping. In every other example of the atomic paranoia B-movies of the Cold War years, the nuclear threat is wholly personified by a fantastic fictional element, that is, of course, the monster, which is always vanquished in the end. Behemoth stands alone in its cautionary message about the very real damage that humankind has done and can still do to our planet. Desmond Davies, the man who worked on the film who later went on to direct Clash of the Titans, had some amusing things to say in his interview, an interview I found of his in Film Facts. Talking about Eugene Lorre, he was asked about his directorial style, and Davis says, he was very easy to work for, really. We found him a rather eccentric sort of guy. His English was fairly iffy, and he was a little guy and very excitable, but very eccentric, we thought. If we ever made any comment about a framing of a shot, he'd say, don't worry, we'll mat that out. So that sort of became a catchphrase for the unit. Everything will be matted out. The director of photography was Ken Hodges. He was a very nice guy. But since Eugene had been a designer and an art director, he had a good eye for camera setups. Most people coming down that route know a lot about composition, and it's always very nice for a camera operator to have somebody with you who actually knows how to compose a frame and doesn't just point the camera any old place. Well, here, on board ship, we get our first glance, very brief, of our monster. And I will be the first to admit, even as someone who really enjoys this film, that our glimpse of the monster is a little underwhelming, and the shot really does not look that great. But, I have to admit, I watch these films, I love, let's state up front, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't love these films. I did not grow up in this time period, and I guess I have kind of a sense of nostalgia for a time that I never lived through. But there's a desire within me, and it's very easy for me to fall into the mindset of the 8-year-old boy or the 10-year-old boy watching these films and just wanting to be swept up in these black and white monster tales. There's our monster. And just go along for the ride. I love one that doesn't push me out of the frame of enjoying it, that allows me to actually get caught up and enjoy myself and look at this and have fun with it, lose myself in it, play that little pretend game that allows you to have fun with something that you know is slightly ridiculous or maybe even completely ridiculous and just go along for the ride. Once again, in this scene, I love the realistic touch of having the clicking Geiger counter giving us an indicator of how close the monster is. And also, I think it's very interesting that the monster's primary way of killing its victims throughout the movie is not through stomping on them or chomping on them. It's this radiation that it's giving off, the same thing that brought it from the depths and causes it to rampage across the land is the thing that's making it actually the most dangerous. It's actually its most dangerous element. I find that to be a very, very fascinating element in a film filled with neat little details. Now, while Mr. Lorre was filming in London and near Cornwall, unbeknownst to him, things were rumbling in Hollywood. David Diamond was dreading the notion of cost overruns by Willis O'Brien and Pete Peterson. Further, it became evident that the sequences like the behemoth attacking the ferry boat were beyond the scope of their limited facilities. Diamond was reluctant to merely farm these sequences out to another shop. Diamond flew to London and revealed to the director that he had drawn up a master contract with Jack Rabin to furnish all the effects for a fixed price. Rabin ran an effects facility called Studio Film Services, and his credits ran the gamut of top-flight films such as the Hollywood film Night of the Hunter, a wonderful film, by the way, all the way down to schlock pictures such as Robot Monster, Viking Women and the Sea Serpent, and Catwoman on the Moon. His company also composited the first season's flying shots, the flying shots for the first season of The Adventures of Superman. Diamond felt he was reliable, and he definitely worked cheap, and so that's why he decided to hire him. Under the new Behemoth deal, O'Brien and Peterson became subcontracted to Rabin. Rabin later complained in an interview in 1980, "I don't think I was given more than $20,000 for that picture." Now, of course, one of the reasons anybody would ever watch this film is because it's a dinosaur movie. And here we have our visit to a dinosaur expert, someone who is going to tell us... No, I'm wrong. Wait. I think I'm in the wrong... We're not there yet. Let me get to something else first. The animation of the behemoth in this film is a testament to what creative and dedicated people can accomplish even under the most trying of circumstances. The walking cycle that Pete Peterson animated the Paleosaurus, as it's called in this film, is arguably the most naturalistic ever done for a movie creature of its supposed size. A believable illusion of great mass is one of the most difficult qualities to achieve with the stop-motion technique, but Peterson, under the tutelage of his master, does it brilliantly. It's puzzling to this day why Lorre always voiced such unqualified disapproval of behemoth animation, as it is quite beautiful. The animal's huge, heavy gait, complementing the zoologically plausible musculature of the puppet itself, imparts a wonderfully weighty look to the stride that has never been surpassed. Careful lighting of both the creature and the miniature sets it inhabits matches the style of the rest of the picture and nicely augments the beautiful ambulation. The work done on this film is even more impressive when you know the background of the two men responsible. Willis O'Brien, of course, is famous for having done King Kong, the original King Kong in 1933. He's the man who created King Kong, did all the stop-motion animation for that film, and as a testament to his ability, he could have probably done nothing else the rest of his career and been highly thought of and held up as a genius until his dying days. This King Kong will always be one of the great accomplishments in screen history. By the time we get to this film, his health was failing, and Peterson had become his not really his assistant, but his protege. But Peterson had problems of his own. O'Brien and Peterson worked out of a concrete building in Reseda near the Encino borderline. It was a bleak and desolate place that looked very much like a cell block. O'Brien wasn't animating anymore, but he was no slouch. He made the behemoth model using cannibalized armature parts and fashioned the body with his time-tested build-up technique. Wads of sponge and cotton fleshed out the body, and layers of liquid latex were applied until the final form was achieved. Oh, here we are. I'll interrupt myself. Here we are in another one of those wonderful little scenes that this film has that most monster films really don't. Here we have the dog barking and the family eating dinner at home. I've always found this scene to be very creepy, even though I think that in a way it's kind of off in a certain, in a way it's a little off, but it plays out very effectively. Dog on a leash, dog escapes, dog runs. Very strange sound we hear when the dog dies. It doesn't really sound like a dog dying. I've heard it described as maybe an elephant screech, an elephant's howl of some sort. And once again, we have the radiation effect, the kind of blurred hypno-wheel effect, as the radiation from the still unseen beast kills more victims. Nice white-out image to give us the fade to the rather grim-looking dead body in the hay. Ah, what a noirish image there. Gosh, that's beautiful. I love black and white photography, and this film really does sport some wonderful black and white photography. It's so nice to be able to in the digital age to get films like this issued in beautiful, beautiful prints on DVD, and to be able to really appreciate the cinematography and the hard work these people put into these films. I always find this scene very strange. The two middle-aged men coming to the door in the middle of the night in their bathrobes. That's a pretty darn big footprint, don't we think? I like that. Did anybody actually see it? Nobody that lived, is the policeman's response. At any rate, back to Willis O'Brien's construction of the behemoth itself. Realistic scales were made from lizard castings and detailed with modeling tools. He also built the mechanical prop of the behemoth's head and neck with Phil Kellison, a miniature maker who did double duty as Jack Raven's effects cameraman and happened to have lived only two blocks away from the Encino shop where O'Brien and Peterson did their work. Kellison built the framework using plexiglass rods and discs, eliminating the need for machined parts. O'Brien wanted to use wood, but Kellison felt that the joints would swell once submerged in Raven's water tank for later on when they shot the ferry boat sequence. The neck was fixed to a board, and control wires were worked by a series of levers. O'Brien covered it with latex skins, which he had made from castings of a real iguana. Incredibly, the articulated prop was finished in just 2 days. Ah, and now another break. Here we have great character actor, British character actor, Jack McGowan. Oh, this is a very serious film, and to be honest, this character provides the only humor in it at all. And it's all McGowan. It's all his ability as a very fine actor and as someone who can bring a lot to even a fairly underwritten role. This is a good sequence, and it is in some ways it's kind of the highlight of any attempt at it is the only attempt at levity in the entire film, and it's a good one. Sorry, I get caught up in watching McGowan. I think he's wonderful. Everyone involved in the film that I can find an interview with has nothing but good things to say about Jack McGowan. Mr. Evans comments on how after working with him in this film, he saw him in 10 or 15 more productions, and he was always a commanding actor, someone who drew your eye automatically. And boy, it's true. Anytime I've ever seen him, he's always unforgettable, no matter how small the role. And in this film, his role is fairly small. But back to talk of our special effects people and their work on this film. Pete Peterson did some stunning animation despite his crippling ailment. He had multiple sclerosis, and by the time he made this film, it was to the point where he literally had to do all of his work while sitting down. The sets for the film were built about 20 inches off the ground, and Pete stop-framed the model in a sitting position. Hand switch was by his side, but the simple procedures like changing the behemoth's tie-downs to move it along the set must have been incredibly hard to do. He always animated alone without an assistant, so anytime you see the behemoth in this film moving around, it is all Pete Peterson's work. Phil Kellison built the miniature cranes decimated by the monster as it emerges from the river and lumbers onto the dock. They were working cranes made of malleable copper and set up so they could be stop-framed and collapse. From the rear of the stage, Kellison observed Peterson's animation of this shot while O'Brien would man the Rackover Mitchell camera used to film the sequences. The quote from Kellison is, "It was a long walk from the back of the setup to the camera's lens. They couldn't follow focus on the behemoth because the background would go out of focus. O'Brien was using a 20mm lens. When I asked what f-stop they were using, OB said, 'Well, we don't know.' What they had done was pull the pin on the leaf of the aperture, enabling them to stop down further than the lens was intended to go. Essentially, they were working with a pinhole camera. O'Brien said, 'We don't know what the aperture is. We just make a test until it's right, and then that's what we light it to.' The whole thing was done by trial and error." Once again, another thing that adds to the feel of this film, adds to the sense of realism, are scenes like this, where we're watching radar and sonar and all this real equipment, and just honestly getting a sense of being in a real place and seeing real things going on. Jack McGowan in the helicopter. Now, I will admit, as a fan of this film, that the one thing in this movie, the one special effect that I really am not very pleased by, although I've already complained about the first shot, the kind of shot that we get of the monster early on when they're on the ship trying to find it, is this strange animated image of the irradiated beast under the water swimming up the river. I've always thought it's a little childish. And when I said animated, and that's not correct, I found information on this. The scene is not actually animated, and I will provide the correct information once we see the shot. There it is. Okay, the glowing outline of the submerged behemoth seen from the helicopter was not cartoon animation, as some people think, as I still continue to say, unfortunately. A plexiglass cutout of the creature's shape was edge-lit against black to create a bold halo, and the cutout was filmed with a rippled glass and printed over the water footage. Just one of the neat little tricks that they found to represent that shot, to get that shot on screen. Sadly, like I say, I just don't think it looks very good, and it looks a little silly. It doesn't quite work. To my mind, what would have worked better would be seeing some kind of light under the water, some kind of blob blobbish light that was indistinct and didn't have such clear delineation. The lines were blurred where it was just a kind of a blobbish image, which would of course entice the curious people in the helicopter to get a little bit closer, trying to get a better look at the thing, which then causes the unfortunate radiation burn and explosion of a helicopter. But that to me is just nitpicking, and the film is wonderful nevertheless. Plus, I gotta tell you, those old helicopters from the 50s, man, they look weird to me. Every time I see one of those helicopters in an older movie, the look of them is just so strange. It's as if they're built out of materials that were laying around, like a tube that was already existing. It's like, okay, we can turn this into a flying machine. It just looks so odd, nevertheless. More footage of planes and ships as we attempt to find out what the heck is going on here anyway. Now we get to one of the most impressive scenes in the film. Although, as I will relate from the wonderful magazine article that I'm plagiarizing horribly, I should point out, by Paul Mandel on the giant behemoth, this sequence, from what I understand, strangely enough, this sequence was not in a videotape release of this film, VHS release, several years ago. I'm assuming it was in the 80s, but I really can't be sure. Very strange, as this is a pretty impressive sequence, and imagining this film without this scene is very odd. I doubt that it would work very well. I'm glad I never saw it without this scene, because the film would not have quite the impact that it does. Once again, lots of footage shot on location give us a sense of what we're looking at and to set us all up for this. Now, the ferry sequence is very impressive. It was all shot in a tank at Jack Rabin's Studio Film Services. Apparently the tank was pretty small, with very little room for lights. Photo cutouts lined the horizon, and tiny barges were built to disguise the rear water line. The entire setup, from the camera lens to the cutouts, was less than 20 feet. Phil Kellison filmed the ferry sequence and built the 30-inch boat using photographs as a guide. There were no blueprints. He was fortunate to discover a new line of English dinky toys. That's the name of them, dinky toys, which matched the vehicles on the real ferry filmed in London. The size of the ferry was dictated by the size of those toys. He also built functional paddles, which didn't register in the picture. Ah, here's our monster. Now, about that monster head. Now, of course, one of the most impressive things about this is that creature right there. Now, see, unfortunately, the mouth isn't moving. Oh, there's the ferry. There it is. Now, it's pushing against the ferry. That was not the original intent, sad to say. They built that neck and head. There are the dinky toys. Look at the dinky toys. Oh, see, okay. It's flipping the ferry. This is a wonderfully well done scene. The shots are matched so well. They did such a good job with this. Now, originally, one of the required actions was that the creature arch his head under the boat. That was the intention. But a very impetuous Irving Block, that's the name of one of the fellows who worked on the film, started playing with the head and neck that O'Brien had built. He got so excited working the levers that he broke them all. During rehearsal, it worked just fine, but by the time they started filming, the neck would no longer arch and the mouth remained open. They had rented lights and a high-speed Mitchell camera and a pump for the tank, and just for that day. They had to shoot it that day or they weren't going to be able to do it. There wasn't money to do it another day, to repair the head so that it would work properly and shoot it another day. So they just had to use the behemoth's head as a battering ram. That's the way it appears in the movie. More of that wonderful makeup on the burned makeup. Also, another wonderful thing about that fairy sequence is that shot of the little girl's doll floating in the water. Just another one of those neat little touches that add to this film's impact immensely. Also these shots of people on the street listening to the radio, going about their business, hearing the news reports. One of the criticisms leveled against this film is that they didn't really have the money or the time to do a lot of big crowd shots for the way that the director had the time and money to do such things for The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. And there are a couple of points where that does hamper the film in a way, but I think they get around it very effectively by including things like this. And later on in the rampage sequences, it's played very effectively and well in filming it at night, giving you a sense of the shadows and things, and therefore you won't be able to see necessarily the big crowds. And also bringing in the camera shots really tight on in certain cases just one or two actors reacting to what's going on. It's very effective for what it is. And of course, for someone like me, all those shots of London in 1957 or 58 are also very very interesting. I like seeing that kind of stuff as well. Now, there are a lot of impressive monster shots in this movie, and the fairy sequence, of course, not stop motion, but still very effective. And we are about to get to what for any monster fan is always the big payoff, especially a monster fan of movies from this era, which is when we finally get to see the monster. All this preparation, everything getting us to this point, building up slowly and carefully. Like I say, one of the criticisms leveled against this film is, I've always heard people complaining about how you don't get to the monster, and then you finally get to the monster at the end, and there's not enough of the monster. Well, I think that's part of what they were aiming for here. This is a very carefully built story. You put the pieces in place and you build them one upon the other. And I like this form of storytelling. This is the kind of thing I like to see. Now, since the monster scenes that are coming up go by far too quickly for me to get all this information in while it's going on, plus I'm always afraid that I'm going to be staring at the screen and not paying attention to the fact that I should be telling you what the heck is happening, I'm going to go on and talk about go further into the information presented by Paul Mandel about the film. Scenes of the monster turning a corner and rampaging down the street were composited on Rabin's printer using area mats. It's a simple split screen, the same way it was done all the way back in 1925 in The Lost World. For the first beauty shot of the behemoth entering a panicked street scene from the screen left, O'Brien delineated a mat line that ran through buildings and a rear row of parked cars. Unwanted portions of the frame showing trees and construction cranes were matted out and replaced with a new horizon of painted rooftops on glass in front of the model. The new sky was not a projection, but an airbrushed backing. An optical zoom-in on the composite gave it a dramatic flourish, and it is a wonderful scene when we get to it. Laurie made sure that the cars were strategically placed in the distance to facilitate a split line, and the haste imposed on O'Brien and Peterson to get this shot done resulted in grease pencil marks on the glasswork visible in the final picture. I may try to point those out as we get to them, but to be honest, I get so caught up in looking at the movements of the monster that I've only paid attention to the grease lines, the grease pencil lines once or twice. Split screen shots had their downside, of course, and when the behemoth passes behind an empty bus, its legs can't be seen through the bus windows. Of course, it's interesting to point out that this is kind of sloppy, and yeah, that Ray Harryhausen's films never had problems like that. But then again, Ray Harryhausen had a little bit more time and money to work on these things, and they were really under the gun. When you consider that the total budget for the special effects was supposedly $20,000, and that was for all of the special effects, I have to admit, I never noticed that you couldn't see the behemoth's legs through the bus windows until it was pointed out when I read Mandel's article here. Maybe I'm just slow, I'm not sure, but honestly didn't notice it until it was pointed out. And of course now I spot it every time, and I don't find it irritating. I have to admit, I find it kind of endearing that there are little flaws like that throughout the picture. I love the chalkboard drawing of the paleosaur with the approximately 70 feet thing. That is one neat thing in this movie, I have to admit. The size of the creature is kept pretty standard. They're unlike in quite a few giant monster movies, there is a tendency in general for the size, the relative size of the creature to fluctuate depending on the shot that the special effects people are putting them into. But they adhere pretty closely to trying to keep the monster's size the same throughout the picture. They stick to it pretty well. I know I'm probably pointing myself out as a ridiculous anglophile for saying this, but man, I love all these shots of London in the 50s. Seeing the bobbies in their hats and seeing London Bridge, all these things. It's just another thing for me to goggle over as a silly American looking at all this stuff. I find it utterly fascinating. It's one of the reasons why I'm drawn to film noir as well, to see these kind of things. And here's the sadly broken monster neck and head again. Very effective stuff here. I love the way this is cut together. Of course, it would be slightly more effective. One could gripe that it would be slightly more effective if one of those shots showed us the sailors and people along the waterfront pointing at the monster with the monster in frame at the same time. But, you know, we all know what we're getting here. Once again, nice build. I love the fact that Edwin Astley's score plays over this sequence without dialogue. And here we get... This is a great shot. Now look at that camera movement as the beast moves up onto land. That took a lot of work. There come the cranes made out of copper. Wonderful stuff. I love looking at this monster walk. Love the detail, the scale detail, the iguana skin detail on the skin. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And the shot, of course, that I described earlier, where the beast walks into frame from the left. Camera pushes in, and very nice stuff. And here we see the car crush. Okay, that's the first time you see that shot, and embarrassingly enough, you're going to see that shot twice more during this rampage. Just another one of the cost-cutting measures, and it is one of the more embarrassing aspects of the creature effects in here. Even a first-time viewer of this film will spot the fact that that car crash scene is shown three times. They do their best to hide the fact that you're seeing the same thing three times, but it's pretty clear and pretty obvious. Of course, the first time we saw it, we were in very, very tightly on the car. Here we're further back, but it's the same shot. Also, it should be pointed out that if you look very closely, and you can stop motion your way through the DVD and get a very nice picture, the ankle of the behemoth's feet were starting to tear a little bit. And there's the third time. And, of course, right before the third time you get to see the car crushed was the bus, where you can't see the behemoth through the windows. But like I said, until it was pointed out, I didn't notice it. And, of course, I now have ruined it for all of you listening to this, because now you'll always see it as well whenever you see the film. Now, like I say, yes, they didn't have nearly as many crowd shots. There's not nearly as many people as in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, but I think that it's very effective here. Now, the radiation coming off from the beast, which is even more dangerous than the beast himself. One of the complaints I have about this film, just from a simple storytelling aspect, is that the radiation coming from off the beast and affecting everything around him seems to come and go. It either should have been more uniform, or they should have dropped it once the creature got on the land and just kind of let us forget about it. But then again, having those poor people scarred and burned it's a pretty effective thing, and it does add to the horror of what's going on. The makeup effects are quite effective on hands and faces, and it is pretty nice, I have to admit. Good stuff. Always like seeing the army get into the act, try to take the giant beastie down. Always completely ineffective. More radiation. Using the radiation, the whiteout to hide the fact that they're flipping the image and getting double use out of the footage they have. And the very gruesome shots of the charred remains, including the push-in on it, which kind of makes it look like a painted image. But anyway, very effective stuff. I've always been impressed by that, and I always think it's very, very exciting. This whole sequence is very, very exciting. Very long sequence of our giant animal attacking everything in sight. Something else that should be pointed out about the car crush scene that we see three times, that we saw three times earlier in the film. Always love how they put together the scene with the monster pushing over the wall onto those people. Very effectively done. That's definitely the sign of a director who knows how to do what he's doing. You know, he's worked with special effects before and knows how to composite these things well. One of the things that I still have trouble noticing about the car crush sequence that is shown three separate times is that because of a problem with the rear projector that they use to put the image in behind the foot crushing the car, if you look very carefully, you can see that the people moving in the shot projected behind the foot as it crushes the car stop and start a few times. It's because they had the projector they had in the studio was broken, didn't work very effectively. But I will say this, until it was pointed out to me, I had never noticed it. Love the shots of the monster howling. Love that. Very good stuff. And of course, that's the reason we all watch these movies, is to see that kind of stuff. Now, as we've had the monster stomp onto land and kill dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds of people, and we move on to how do we fix this problem? What in the world are we going to do? And much like the solution found in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, we got to shoot it. That's our big answer, and it's always going to be our big answer with the giant monster. I mean, that's That's just the kind of people we are. Gotta shoot the monkey. Gotta shoot the monster. So, in Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, we had Lee Van Cleef shoot a radioactive bullet into our poor critter. In this, we're going to use a warhead, a torpedo. But more monster footage. Good stuff. Coming up is a wonderful scene. Wonderful scene. Oh, I love this. The electrical line sequence. Once again, I defer to Paul Mandel's article. Good stuff here. Pete Peterson animated an exquisite shot of the behemoth walking into high-tension wires at night. The electrical effects were doubled in later. As the wires are knocked down, they fall on a gas tank, causing it to explode. We'll get to that in just a second. In this scene, you once again see the movement of the image. It's a camera move up as the beast comes toward us. And that is pretty unique in stop motion animation. A camera movement while the creature is moving. Now see that shot there? Okay, the gas tank. As the wires fell down, they fell on a gas tank, causing it to explode. Now Phil Kellison explains that there's a reason the gas tank looked kind of strange. It's not on screen very long, and then, like I say, it's not something that I ever really noticed that much. But As Phil Kellison explains, there was a real gas tank at Goldwyn Studio down the street, which I was going to replicate in miniature. I figured it would take 3 or 4 days to build the model, but they couldn't wait. Without knowing it, Irving Block, the same Irving Block who broke all the levers on the head of the big mock-up, Irving Block stacked a bunch of film cans on a pile of sand and photographed it. They then superimpose an explosion over that. That's why the gas tank had those particular striations all around it. It annoyed the hell out of me because I didn't get a chance to build the miniature, but I had to admire Blocky's kutzpah for doing something like that. And you gotta think about it. They got away with it. They actually got away with it. They got away with stacking film cans on a pile of sand and superimposing an explosion over it instead of building a miniature. Here we have some effective night scenes as the creature. There's some very effective night scenes. Photo cutouts used in place of miniature sets here. And, of course, in black and white, it looks wonderful. In color, it would not have worked. The House of Parliament, where the beast emerges at night, was all flat cutouts on masonite board, as was the entire London skyline. An animated spotlight conveyed the impression of dimensionality as it roamed over the photo facades. Of course, we get the monster picking up the car, chomping on it, and slinging it. And I'm betting money that's another dinky toy that goes into the water there. One of the funnier things that I didn't mention about the fairy sequence earlier was that Phil Kellison filmed scenes of the dinky toys dropping into the water as a test to prove to David Diamond, who was such an incredible tightwad, just how bad the footage would look. And Diamond looked at it and without further deliberation just cut it into the picture as it was. See, sir, it's going to look bad. Could we have some more money so we can make it look good? It looks good enough. Put it in the picture. That's cost cutting. That's the way to save money, folks. Once again, I love the realism of, sort of realism. We never get a shot of the submarine here on the docks, of course, so that we see the whole thing. But I love the idea of this being a real place, or at least looking like a real place, and we're in these real places dealing with this monstrous creature. Once again, just to be a little movie geek, man, I absolutely love seeing all these shots of London at night. Love this stuff. Another weird-looking helicopters again. I'm telling you, they look like tubes that somebody turned into a flying machine. Anyway, I'm going to read something Paul Mandel says here about the film near the end of his article. I don't completely agree with it, but I'm going to read it out because it seems to be kind of one of the standard ways in which people look at this film. Ultimately, all the neat little effects tricks cannot rescue Behemoth from a certain amateurish pall and obvious corner cutting. Even the original Godzilla, for all its warts, had a grander feel and a lot more imagination and verve in the effects design. Gaffes in Behemoth are puzzling. When the farmer's dog is smitten by the monster off camera, we hear an elephant trumpet instead of a canine yelp. Now, I'm going to insert here myself that I listened to that sound again and again, and he refers to it as an elephant trumpet, but I'm not altogether sure. It really does not sound like a dog, I'll admit, but I don't know. Back to Mr. Mandel. And was the first shot of the creature's neck breaching the water tank almost imperceptibly deliberate or an editing mistake? That neck in the water seated with dry ice made for a lousy death scene, and a visible smoke pot spewing white vapor on the real River Thames seems unforgivable. As the aftermath of the torpedoed Behemoth many fathoms below, it made no sense. Even cheap sea monsters deserve better ends. Of course, I'm leaping ahead to his end there, but I think Mr. Mandel's a little hard on the film. I think that it's got a lot more charm than he gives it credit for. I find the film highly entertaining, and if I were going to rate it, no, of course, it is probably the weakest of the three films that Eugene Warre directed. Yes, it is. But I like it better than I like Gorgo. Gorgo is a fan favorite. It always has been because of its kind of warm, fuzzy storyline. But this one I like so much simply because of its almost documentary style of filmmaking, the very real feeling you get from the location shooting. And the strong acting across the board. There's some very good stuff here. To wrap up some stuff about this film's place in stop motion history. Pete Peterson was a Danish born man, and his career could have been even more impressive, in my opinion. He did superb work during his first stint of work on Mighty Joe Young. He did the scene of Joe on the back of the truck in the film. His tail-stinging monsters in The Black Scorpion were beyond reproach. Peterson's solo animation of the Behemoth was clearly inspired by Willis O'Brien's work in The Lost World and King Kong. And O'Brien taught him everything he knew, but the clinical finery of Pete's work put him in Ray Harryhausen's league. Ray's trademarks were specific nuances and an exaggerated theatricality. In Behemoth, Peterson focused on the grace of the animal and the naturalistic shifting of its weight. The swift lurch and arc of the Behemoth's neck was a particular move Peterson pulled off realistically, with hardly any stop-motion chatter. It's good stuff. The hypno wheel again. And I really like the shots of the swimming creature as well. Giant Behemoth was the swan song of the stop motion of the giant stop motion monster decimating the big city, and I have to agree with Mandel. I really, really miss it. A renaissance of this type of picture must be waiting in the wings. Imagine a remake of Beast from 20,000 Fathoms using computer generated magic to conjure up things like we had in Jurassic Park. It would be nice, but I'll be honest, I don't know that it would have half the charm this film has. Now, one complaint I would have about the acting in this film is there are a few scenes where the Brit actors seem to be kind of underplaying it to the point of ridiculousness, and there's at least one or two scenes where Evans, our American star, is really kind of carrying the scene a little bit. See, he's the one with the energy level. He's the one who's actually doing the heavy lifting to make the scene interesting. It's not a complaint, really, against the British actors. In a way, it's a difference in style, but I can't believe I'm talking over this as we're trying to kill our beast. Anyway, I like the dripping water and the two-man sub. And maybe they do draw the tension out here of shooting the creature a little too long. But in a very odd move for a monster movie of this time period, the Giant Behemoth closes on a very strange open-ended note. It's almost an implication that there would have been a sequel. The director, Laurie, said, the picture starts with the discovery of dead fish. This gave me the idea to end the picture with a jolt of anxiety. Mountains of dead fish were now washing up on American shores from Maine to Florida. Not to invite a sequel, really, but rather to say to the audience, beware. And I think that is an excellent idea for an ending for the film. It does give us a very somber, sober ending to a film that has been very somber and sober. Films like this are easy to make fun of and easy to not take seriously. This one strives very hard within its meager budget and within its meager means to be a very serious film and to be one that you can take seriously, you can take at face value and enjoy and not feel as if you're being talked down to. These are people working very hard to make as good a film as they could. Yes, they could have used more money. Yes, they could have used more time. But they worked to the best of their ability, and they did a fine, fine job. The fact that 20 years later, we can sit and watch this film in digital glory at home and revel in the beauty of it is a testament to its strengths. Hope you've enjoyed this commentary track. This is my first one, so I know it was pretty rough. I hope everybody enjoyed it. And if you've got any comments, any critiques of my commentary, please let me know. I'm sure I'll be able to get my email address to anyone who listens to this. Once again, thank you very much, and thank you for listening.